Coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. In Australia, we love saying no worries, and though it's an expression we use without a second thought, if I ask you to pause and think about whether you really had no worries at all, I bet you'd probably come up with a long list of things that do worry you. Today, I'd love to hear from you about worrying and how it affects you. And I have a special guest who's here to lift the lid on what's happening in our brains when we worry. And in about 40 minutes, the aunties take on a clash of parent versus grandparent. Let's talk. Our brains are evolved to worry. But I wonder if you've ever felt like worrying just makes you feel worse. I've definitely been there. Today, you'll meet someone who, after reaching that point themselves, learned how to change their thinking patterns and then went on to teach thousands of others how to do it as well. But first, I'd love to know, do you think of yourself as a worrier? If so, how's that working out for you? If you've got a worrier in your life, I'd love to hear how that affects you as well. Because I'd love to hear about the role of worry in your life, helpful or unhelpful. Dr. Russ Harris. He's a physician, a psychotherapist, author, and internationally renowned expert on the evidence-based therapeutic model known as ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. Russ's book, The Happiness Trap, Stop Struggling, Start Living, has sold more than a million copies and was mentioned recently in a New York Times article about self-help books that therapists read themselves. Dr. Russ Harris, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Russ, when we talk about worries, what are we actually talking about?
In talking about worry, we need to be clear about the difference between that and anxiety. So like coming here this morning to do your show, I had high levels of anxiety and they've just gone through the roof right now. Oh. You've put me on the spot. I don't know if you can see my hands, but they're kind of like...
Oh, dear. Russ, I'm here to support you.
So, you know, my hands are red and shiny and dripping with sweat. And as soon as you asked me that question, that I had a knot in my stomach and tightness in my chest. And that's anxiety. That's not worry. Worry is a cognitive process. It's a thinking process where we're thinking about bad things that will or might happen and wondering how bad it's going to be and if there's anything we can do and how will we cope. So you can have anxiety without worrying. I'm not worrying right now, but my anxiety is high because this is a, you know, I don't know how it's going to go.
Can I help you with your anxiety in any way?
Well, what I've learned to do over the years and what I've taught many people to do is how to actually open up and make room for those feelings of anxiety that are normal in your body. That's just your body preparing for a challenging situation. And we want to distinguish that from worrying, getting all caught up in the thoughts about, oh, I might say the wrong thing, I might sound stupid, she might ask me a question that I don't know how to answer and all that kind of stuff. They're quite different.
Well, I've got text here telling me that I'm pronouncing worrier incorrectly. So, you know, anxiety, worry, live radio. Margaret, thank you for your message. It's just that I don't have an Australian accent, Margaret. I hope that you can accept that.
Neither.
30% of Australians were born overseas. To cite that census statistic. And now, but let's get back to worry. From an evolutionary perspective, why do we do it, Russ?
Yeah, well, so if we go back 200,000 years, between 200,000 to 300,000 years, Homo sapiens appears on the planet. And at that basic point in evolutionary history, we've got the same basic needs as every other animal on the planet. Food, water, shelter, sex are the primary needs. But none of those things is important if you're dead. So the number one job your brain has to do is to keep you safe, make sure nothing kills you. And so worrying is sort of a human cortex, the cortex, the thinking layer of our brain, has developed worrying as a strategy to try to anticipate threats, dangers, things that might hurt us, harm us, or our loved ones, and come up with ways of planning and protecting and addressing, either stopping those threats from happening or reducing their impact. And so it probably started as a very useful sort of problem-solving strategy. You know, the cave man or cave woman that was better able to predict a threat and prepare for it was more likely to survive it and pass on their genes to the next generation.
So that all sounds good, but when does it tip into not being so good for us?
Well, what's happened with modern society, you know, is that same strategy can now apply to all sorts of things that may never happen or will not be particularly severe if they happen. So to paraphrase Mark Twain, I've lived through thousands of frightening experiences in my life, and a few of them actually happened. You know, so most of us will have known, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, lying there awake, anticipating bad things are going to happen. And a lot of the time they don't. Sometimes they do, though. So one of the things that keeps worrying going is that sometimes it does actually prepare you and help you come up with a strategy to deal with the worst. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps it going. But unfortunately, a lot of the time, you end up spending a lot of mental energy on things that are not actually severe or are not going to happen.
Kind of spinning out, really. Yeah. It's a bit of a spiral. Now,
That's a good spiral. You know, it's like cars spinning in the sand, like car wheels spinning in the sand. You can think of it as problem solving that's gone a bit haywire.
Then you're doing a lot of work, but nothing is happening. This book that you've written, The Happiness Trap, has been a massive success, sold more than 1 million copies. Russ, I note that the first chapter of your book is called Life is Difficult. And then a core theme of your book, you actually say it, is Life is Pain, which sounds quite dire. How does kind of speaking these rather hard truths or views help people who are consumed by worry?
Well, I think it's a healthy antidote to the, you know, pop psychology movement of positive psychology and just think positive and think optimistic and, you know, lovely song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I love the song, but the message is completely unrealistic. You know, life is difficult. Life is challenging. You may have brief periods where everything's going according to the way you like it, but it won't be long before there are problems showing up in your relationships or health or finances or, you know, the government. Life is difficult.
Right. So if we look at that and we accept that as the baseline, I suppose it's easier to go up from there.
Well, it's just realistic, really. You know, I mean, I run a lot of training workshops around the world, and I always ask audiences, you know, hands up if there's anybody here who's just so blissfully happy and life is just so joyous and wonderful. You'd really like a little bit more stress in your life because you're just getting bored with the perpetual bliss and happiness, you know, and no one puts their hands up. You know, everyone's got problems and stresses, right?
A bit of struggle and adversity can, you know, be very interesting, make things interesting. But coming back to the book, you know, the chapter is called Life is Difficult, and it's called The Happiness Trap. What is The Happiness Trap?
Well, the title reflects the concept that popular ideas about happiness are often misleading, inaccurate, and will make you miserable if you base your life on them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, 1-300-225-5576 is the number to call in and talk to me, Beverly Wang, and Dr. Russ Harris on ABC Radio National's Life Matters this morning about the concept of worry. Are you a worrier? Are you not a worrier? How does that affect you either way? What are your tips and tricks? You can also ask Dr. Russ a question. Of course, he can only offer general advice. Only Margaret in New South Wales, welcome to Life Matters. What do you want to say about worrying?
Oh, good morning, Beverly. I'm not a worrier, but I worked as a midwife for a long time, and I took this lady's blood pressure one day, and it was quite high. And I said, gee, your blood pressure's up a little bit. Are you a worrier? Oh, yes, she said. And I said, well, tell me one thing that worrying has achieved for you. And she said, well, high blood pressure, of course.
That's interesting.
I can't argue that one. Well, but I'm not a worrier, no.
Well, that's interesting. Russ, I want to bring it to you because you are not just a psychotherapist, you're a physician. So can you talk a bit about the physiological impact of worrying?
Yeah, I can. If I can just refer to the comment, though, you know, it's kind of, if you talk to most people that are problem worriers, most of them know logically and rationally that worrying doesn't help. And so it can be quite frustrating if you point out to someone, well, you know, worrying's not going to achieve anything here. What's the point? That if you are lucky enough to be one of those people that isn't a worrier, then enjoy that. But recognize you're in a tiny percentage of the population. And most people do worry. And if you kind of say to someone, well, you know, if there's something you can do about it, do it. But if there's not, there's no point worrying about it. Most people are just going to find that completely unhelpful. And, you know, it's not really a matter of just using logic, which we can talk about, to break the habit of worrying, particularly if it's deeply entrenched, is not just a simple matter of saying to yourself, oh, there's nothing to worry about, or what's the point?
Saying, telling somebody don't worry in a time of crisis is a natural instinct because I think we want to comfort, but in reality, it's, how do you drop that worry when you're in it, when, you know, things are hard?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's kind of the emotions don't usually respond to logic. If they did, life would be a lot easier. But, you know, emotions like anxiety and the cognitive processes that go hand in hand with them, like worrying, require a lot more than a little bit of logic.
We are too highly evolved, Russ. This is what I think sometimes. I'm Beverly Wang with Dr. Russ Harris. He's a physician, psychotherapist, and author of the million copy bestseller, The Happiness Trap, Stop Struggling, Start Living. Russ, if we could go to your personal story just for a second, because you walked this path where you started as a physician, and something happened along the way that led you now to more of the psychology field and ACT. Can you tell me about that story?
I trained in medicine in the in England, in Newcastle, and I came to Australia, to Melbourne, when I was in my mid-20s. And I had followed all the conventional pathways that we're told will give us a successful life. I had a good job. I had status. I had a meaningful work as a GP. I was living in Melbourne, one of the, you know, the world's most livable city. So why wasn't I happy? I was actually really miserable. I was depressed. I was stressed. I was anxious. To try and push my anxiety and my misery away, I was eating lots and lots of junk food, huge amounts of chocolate in particular on a bad day. You know, it's like I was working there as a GP, and, you know, in my drawer, I had all these packets of double coated chocolate Tim Tams. And on a bad day, I'd easily get through four packets.
Wow.
So, you know, and there in my mid-20s, I was morbidly overweight, you know, much bigger than I am today. And I had high blood pressure, not from worrying, but from being overweight and unfit. And I thought, why am I so miserable? I've done, you know, I've got the job, I've got the status, I've got the
you
income.
Climbed the ladder.
I've climbed the ladder. Like, why aren't I happy? And it's my own kind of personal struggle with depression and anxiety that led me to become increasingly interested in the psychological aspects of health and well-being, and kind of eventually pulled me away from the more, you know, physical side of medicine and the writing prescriptions. And I became increasingly interested in my, back then I used to call them patients, now I call them clients, but, you know, their psychological components of the problems that was bringing them to the medical clinic. And I started to, you know, learn how to deal with my own depression and anxiety. And I started to realize I was actually in the wrong profession. And I gradually, over a period of years, changed from being a GP to a psychotherapist.
And how are your stress and anxiety levels now that you've changed?
Well, over the years, I've learned much, much better ways of dealing with them. So I'm, you know, these days I'm a healthy weight and I'm fit, and, you know, it's funny, I'm 59 and I have lower blood pressure than I had in my mid-20s, and you know, I still get stressed, but most of the time I use the skills that I write about and teach people, and it helps me most of the time. I'm not perfect. There's always room for improvement, but to handle my kind of stress and anxiety much better. So I'm pleased to say depression's a thing of the past. But of course, you know, stressful things happen and I still have intense emotions. And if I can link this back to two of your earlier comments, one is you know, coming back to the idea of the happiness trap, the most common misunderstanding, if you like, is the idea that the way to be happy is to control your emotions, get rid of all the unpleasant, unwanted emotions, and replace them with pleasant emotions. And if that's your idea of happiness, then that's actually setting you up for depression and anxiety disorders. Because the research is crystal clear that the more effort and energy you put into trying to control your emotions to avoid or eliminate the bad ones, actually, the greater your risk is of depression and anxiety disorders.
And so perhaps in contrast, naming them might be another way, just like you named your anxiety at the top of the show.
Yeah, well, what I did and what I'm still doing is I'm acknowledging my anxiety is here and I'm recognizing it's a normal emotional response to a challenging situation. I guess if I'd done these kind of interviews a million times, maybe there'll come a point where I don't have that anxiety, but I still
it's
need to do...
It's a very normal response. I hope we can... you're doing great, just by
well,
the
do
way.
Do you ever feel anxious when you're doing this?
Oh, 100%. Sometimes you get a bit tongue-tied, you get a bit sweaty, but, you know, it's also fun. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, so it's normal, isn't it? You know, and kind of anxiety and excitement are very close to each other. They both mean you're stepping out of your comfort zone, you're doing something that's challenging. And so it's just your body preparing you for that challenge. Mm. But what happens is if I start trying to avoid and get rid of my anxiety, I've got to make it go away. Oh, no, here's anxiety. That's a bad thing. Then actually the anxiety starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And, yep.
Oh, we're just going to take a call now. Janet is in Adelaide. Welcome to Life Matters, Janet.
Hello.
What made you want to share about worry? What's happening with you?
Some of the things that you were discussing really rang a bell with me. And in February last year, 24, my husband was diagnosed with mouth cancer. And 2 days later, we knew we wouldn't be traveling like we normally do. And we bought a dog, a new little puppy dog. And that was a great boost for us because he became very important to us to manage Sinclair's illness. He had to have a significant operation, a huge operation in intensive care for 21 days. And I had a lot to go through. And coming home to that little puppy and finding places to leave him during the day became my challenge as well as dealing with the illness.
Yeah, that's huge, Janet, to have, you know, pets, I think, are a really big help when it comes to worry and anxiety, aren't they, Russ?
Yeah, I mean, pets are a great example. Really, if we can expand that to any close, meaningful relationships are such an important antidote, I guess, towards anxiety. But again, the key thing is, you know, one of the lovely things about dogs and cats is it's very easy for us to be really present and engaged with them. Imagine if you're kind of spending time with your dog and your cat and you're not present at all. You're just all caught up in your thoughts and your worries, then you'll miss out on that interaction. So one of the things that I encourage people to do with pets is kind of teach them how to really kind of, you know, hone in on the stroking of the fur or the cuddling or the purring of the cat or the, you know, the whatever, you know, the pet is just really being present and enjoying those aspects. And when you realize you're getting pulled into your worries, then kind of noticing that and bringing your attention back to your interaction with your pet. And if we can extend that to other relationships or really any activity that you're during the day, noticing that you've kind of got hooked in your worries and refocusing your attention, focusing fully on what you're doing, engaging in it to the best of your ability, that's going to make a huge difference.
Let's take another call together, Russ. Luke is in Sydney. Welcome to Life Matters, Luke. What's your worrying status?
So I think that there's definitely anxiety in my gene pool. I can see it in my father, and it's probably part of the reason why I've chosen to be a psychologist in my profession. So that's definitely another part of my life where that kind of there's an element of worrying and assessing risk, but also now having a family, and you know, my wife's quite an anxious person, and now my daughter is presenting with more anxious symptoms. So I feel like it's always been a companion or an adversity in some respects. So now I'm thinking maybe I need to take a step back in terms of my career, maybe seeing less clients, or maybe moving out of a client-facing role. So I guess I'm just thinking sometimes, you know, there's you just got to make it like a bit of a life change to just take some of those things to worry about out of your life picture.
I'd love to bring you in here, Russ, and feel free to chat directly to Luke if you like. But what are you hearing in Luke's story at the moment?
What I'm hearing, Luke, is that there's lots of stress in the work that you do, and you know, being any sort of mental health practitioner, you're exposed to so many distressing and difficult stories, and you know, you're in touch with painful emotions all day long, and it has an impact. And so, of course, a big risk in mental health professionals is burnout and vicarious trauma from your clients. So, you know, one thing obviously important to consider: are you in the right profession? But another thing to consider is, are you, you know, using the skills that therapists need to do to really manage their own thoughts and feelings, you know, learning how to accept difficult feelings, how to unhook from your thoughts, refocus attention, make room for emotions, practice self-compassion, and, you know, putting all those kind of self-care strategies into place. Because very often you'll find that if you do that, then that may alter your decision about whether you need to leave that profession or not. And I just can extend that to really anybody who's in stressful work. One thing is to consider the work itself, but the other thing is to consider how you're looking after yourself within that context of work.
And I wonder, to Luke's point about being a genetic worrier or anxious, can we actually pass on? Is this in our genes, whether we're worriers or anxious?
Well, it's definitely a genetic component. You can see there are families where, you know, there people are more prone to depression, anxiety, and so forth. If you look at it across the general population, you'll see a bell curve distribution, sort of a distribution shaped like a sort of curved hill or bell. And there'll be people at one end that have very low levels of anxiety and worrying, and people at the other hand that have very high levels of anxiety and worrying. And most of us are just somewhere in the middle of that curve.
Luke, thank you for your call. I'm wishing you all the best. Maybe you might feel a bit lighter today if you share some of those worries with me, Beverly Wang, and Dr. Russ Harris here on Life Matters. We're talking about worrying. Have you ever had a point in your life where you found your worries became so incessant that you couldn't ignore them? Did you find or learn a new way to manage? We've got a lot of texts here for you, Dr. Russ. I'm just calling you Dr. Russ. Hope that's okay.
Yes, cool. or Russ is fine.
Many people thanking you for your recordings, for your book, saying that your book lives permanently on their bookshelves. So just want to share that great feedback with you. But let's go to
fantastic
Joanne on Ngunnawal Country in Canberra. Tell me your story, Joanne.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Look, I suppose my challenge has been living with my husband, who has chronic and acute sort of anxiety, depression, OCD traits. And it's sort of taken me years, I suppose, to learn how to manage that, how to cope with that. And then recently having my own life-threatening disease that I'm living with. And so I've had to, I suppose my learning curve has been getting to know myself, getting to know my own heart and soul, which I've had to do through meditation and being still and quiet, and therapy as well, to continue to get to know myself so that I can communicate better, know my own boundaries. And it's been sort of a real journey of managing that worry, if you want to call it, around all that area, to live a life more full. And the big secret for me is holding both. The issues aren't going to go away. So I'm having to hold both the sort of the disappointment, maybe the pain, the challenges that's always before me, as well as really enjoying what I see out the window and what's around and my own family.
Russ, you're nodding along there. Tell me what you're hearing in Joanne's call.
Yeah, well, Joanne's highlighted some really important things in terms of dealing with worry and in terms of enhancing happiness. One is kind of getting in touch with your values. You know, what kind of person do you want to be? What matters to you deep in your heart? What do you want to stand for in the face of the challenges you're dealing with? And then using those values to guide your actions. So this is a big, important part of getting to know yourself and what matters and what you care about. And then and using those values as a compass to guide what you do. The other thing that, you know, highlighted there is this ability, you know, looking out of the window, just enjoying, appreciating the things in your life that are going well. That doesn't magically get rid of all the problems. It's something that you can do in addition to all the problems. So, you know, in everyday language, we talk about, you know, appreciate the small things or stop and smell the roses. But that's actually very hard to do if you're all caught up in your worries. So, you know, the thing is that people need to actually learn some skills to unhook from their worries and refocus their attention if they are to follow that, that, you know, very good idea. And Joanne mentioned meditation. That's one way of learning those skills. Acceptance and Commitment Therapy Act teaches those same skills, but in a much simpler, easier to learn format. You don't have to meditate. You can learn quite quickly how to refocus your attention and engage in what you're doing and appreciate what's happening that is desirable.
Well, let's pause for a moment, and I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. You've written a book that's very popular about it. What are the kind of the core concepts? And you've also mentioned something called hooking and unhooking. Can you just explain that a bit more?
Yeah, so hooking basically, you know, we all have lots of thoughts and feelings, and the more difficult the thoughts and feelings are, the more likely they are to dominate our awareness or our actions or both. And that's what I mean by being hooked, like a fish on the end of a hook. Your thoughts and feelings jerk you around. They tell you what to do. They dictate your choices. They dominate your awareness, so you can't really focus on anything else. And so unhooking skills are not ways to get rid of those thoughts and feelings. That's simply unrealistic, but ways to take the power out of them, ways to rapidly take the power out of all of those worrying thoughts, or take the power out of those unpleasant feelings in your body of anxiety, so that you can come back to your values and behave like the person you want to be and focus your attention on what you're doing and engage in what you're doing.
That's a very key concept, I think, because I think some people cope by pushing away, denial, and that's not the same thing.
No, right? Absolutely.
It's actually acknowledging it, but maybe just making it go in the corner, not right in front of you.
Well, sitting with it or opening up or making room for it.
Oh, yeah, that's a better analogy.
You know,
yeah.
Just allowing it to freely flow through you. So you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of people, I'll try and distract from it. I'll try and suppress it. I'll try and push it away. I'll try and think positively. And all of those things work quite well for a short space of time if your anxiety is not very high or the problems you're dealing with are not very severe. But they don't work when you're really dealing with intense emotions. They don't work when you're dealing with real major problems in life. And as I mentioned earlier, the research is clear that the more you're trying to avoid and escape unwanted emotions and unwanted cognitions, the technical term for this is experiential avoidance. So the higher your level of experiential avoidance, the greater your risk of all sorts of different mental health disorders, not just depression, anxiety disorders, OCD, but also addiction, substance abuse. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on.
Well, Russ, you have a lot of people who are calling in who want to chat. To talk to Russ, who's written the book The Happiness Trap, sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It's about Acceptance and Commitment Therapy ACT. Julie in Adelaide, welcome to Life Matters. You describe yourself as a serial worrier. Tell us more.
Yeah, I would say I am, but in saying that, you know, I'm highly functional, and I still actually look at life like it's very good. So, but I would say on a daily basis, I would be worrying. There'd be something that would worry me, and not always big worries. I mean, I've had some big worries, and I've had my fair share of sleepless nights over many years now. But I think overall, and I've also done a lot of work on myself and a lot of soul searching and whatever. So I think that's kind of held me in good stead to keep the worry from, you know, dominating or making my life.
Can I ask you, Julie,
absolute misery.
What is the source of your worries?
To be honest, most of my worries would be about my family and my children, about the health of my children, really, and grandchildren. And that stems from an event that happened a long time ago, and my kids would hate me to hear me say this, because I look at them and I know they're healthy and they're all happy, but I can always worry and see what they could be doing better, or, you know, how, not better, but how things could be better. So, I just worry, I think, for them. But most of the time, you know, that's okay. They're doing a great job, and we all have a good time. And, I mean, I worry, sometimes I worry so much that I might have a day where I'm actually feeling pretty good and everything's going all right, and then I'll have one worrying thought that'll just pass through my mind from one side of my mind to the other, and then I'll forget it. But then I'll spend the rest of the day trying to rethink what that was, you know, like just to bring it back into my awe. But it's also, like I say, it's not totally detrimental to me. I'm kind of okay with it all now. I've found a nice balance, but I am a worrier, that's for sure.
That idea of hooking and unhooking that Russ just mentioned, do you find that helpful?
Yes, absolutely. It's really, that's why I'm tuning in very keenly to this conversation. So, absolutely. Now, I probably will get a hold of this book myself and have a read.
Any words for Julie before we move on, Russ?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that Julie said there is that, it's not always detrimental. You know, worrying at times does help us. It is a form of problem solving. It helps us anticipate threats, plan for threats, come up with strategies. Worrying always points us to things that are important and meaningful. So you can, use it as a pathway to connect with your values. Like, I've asked thousands of people to complete this sentence. I might ask you, actually.
Okay.
10 years from now, looking back on today, what did you spend too much time worrying about?
Oh, gosh. whether the shirt I put on this morning should have first been laundered before I put it on. Yeah.
I mean, what I find is the three most common answers, and Julie gave one of them, is one is my children and my grandchildren. You know, obviously, if you don't have kids, you won't be worried about that. But the other two are money, and the third one is other people's opinions of me or how other people think of me.
Okay, so maybe body odor is related to that.
Well, I guess if we're worried about our clothes or appearance, it really is. You know, why would you be worried if you were by yourself at home in lockdown? You wouldn't, would
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's know? Right. I love the honesty, both of ours, all of ours here on Life Matters. We have a lot of calls. I wonder, before I move on, we've talked about hooking and unhooking. There's another technique called dropping anchor, which I think might be helpful to our previous caller. Can you talk about that?
I could do, or I could take the listeners through it if
you
want.
Yeah, sure.
It's kind of, so basically, when a ship's sailing into the harbour and a big storm blows up, or the first thing that boat needs to do is drop anchor. If it doesn't drop anchor in the harbour, when the storm comes in, it's going to get blown out to sea. And so when an emotional storm blows up, anxiety or worry, we need to drop anchor so that our own emotional storm or cognitive storm doesn't carry us away. So if listeners want to give this a go, there's three simple steps to this. The first step is you just take a moment to acknowledge what you're feeling, just kind of put a name to it. Here's anxiety or here's worry, and you just notice what's showing up in your body. Am I tight in my chest? Are there knots in my stomach? And as you notice it, you just kind of acknowledge that this is a normal emotion, that everybody feels this way. You're just allowing it to be there. So here's anxiety. It's a normal emotion. I'm not going to fight it. You just allow it. The second piece of dropping anchor is you do some sort of physical movement and you really notice it, not to distract yourself from the emotion, but to recognize that you've got some control over your actions. You have a capacity for action in this moment. So if you're listening to this, then maybe have a stretch, kind of I here in the studio, we're stretching, we're moving or straightening up, or maybe taking a slow breath and noticing the movement of your rib cage. So to see that you can take action even with anxiety present. And then the third step is to refocus your attention on what you're doing right here, right now. So I'm giving all my attention back to you across the booth here, and I'm engaging in the conversation. You know, and the idea is to cycle through that two or three times, acknowledging the anxiety, allowing it to be there, doing some physical movement and recognizing I've got some control of my actions here. You know, it's very important if you're the sort of person that tends to get paralyzed by anxiety, just even wiggling your fingers, wiggling your toes, straightening your back. And then the third thing is bringing your attention back to what you're doing and engaging in what you're doing. That first bit is so important, because if you miss that out, the acknowledging and naming and allowing feeling of the anxiety, this is going to turn into a distraction technique, and that won't work. You'll get rebound anxiety. You might be able to distract yourself from it for a moment, but it's going to come back. So it's about acknowledging it, allowing it, letting it be there, acknowledging it's a normal emotion. This is your body preparing for a challenge, your mind trying to keep you safe, and doing some mindful movement, stretching, moving, noticing, and then bringing your attention back to, what am I doing right here, right now? What's important in this moment?
Well, Russ, how about we take another call? Edgar's in Jervis Bay, New South Wales. Welcome to
Hello.
Life Matters. Tell me about your relationship to worrying.
I think I'm having a challenging time in my relationship, my intimate relationship with my wife, and I'm, you know, working through it by writing in a diary and sort of doing physical exercise and that kind of thing, and part of a men's group where we discuss things. And I had a real realization, something that resonated with your guest's talk point about the happiness trap. I was sort of talking through my experience, and that I had unfulfilled expectation of what my relationship should look like, right? And in that moment, I could kind of stop worrying about it. I think it's worry because I overthink. I'm a bit of an overthinker, and I think the worry is a symptom of that, I suppose. And yeah, so I was worried that my relationship is going a certain way, thinking that it should be a certain, thinking it should look a certain way, and then when I kind of acknowledged, okay, that's just my unfulfilled expectation, I could kind of be at peace with it.
Edgars, thank you so much for your call. I'm so sorry the line quality is a bit poor, so we'll have to let you go, but I think we got the gist of it. And it was interesting, Edgars, outlining what he thought it should be like, yes, and what it actually is like. I'd love to hear your reflections there.
Well, again, our minds are very good at conjuring up the ideal, what's happening in the world, and comparing that to the reality of what's happening in the world. And of course, there's the bigger the gap between my reality and how I expect the world to be, the more discontent that shows up. So this plays a role in all sorts of uncomfortable emotions, this kind of mismatch between the life I want and the life I actually have. And, you know, there's another piece of the puzzle here, which is, it's not enough just to unhook from the thoughts, make room for the feelings and refocus your attention. You also need to learn how to do effective problem solving. So if there are relationship issues going on, like in this example, then it's not enough just to stop the worrying about it. It's also, what's my action plan here? What values do I want to live as a partner? What kind of relationship do I want to build with my partner? What are some actions that I can take, whether that's just having a heart-to-heart conversation or whether that's something further, like actually going to couples counseling? But you know, if you think worrying is a problem, an ineffective problem-solving strategy, we need to replace it with an effective one. So come back to your values and come up with some concrete actions that I can take to change the situation or look after myself within the situation.
Let's take possibly who might be our final call, Kiri in Victoria. Kiri, you want to talk about catastrophizing. Go ahead.
Look, I see things from a diverse perspective. I suffered a lot of trauma in my background. My dad's a Holocaust survivor, and I think context is everything. Because of my transferred post-traumatic stress, I tended to catastrophize, and I've had to work on not seeing the worst in things, but that's really ancestral. It's not genetic so much. I mean, there's a genetic component. But I'm interested to hear Russ's opinion on the gender, cultural, sociological aspects. You know, if you're born in a different part of the world where there's a lot of war, and also why aren't we learning more about emotional dealing and managing with dealing with our emotions earlier on in our life as we grow up? Where are the courses and for families and students? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great questions. Over to you, Russ.
Great questions. And, you know, you've raised an important point. These things are multifactorial. Genes, environment, culture, the family you've grown up in, the school you've gone to, the relationships you're in, you know, even just the relationship you have with the people that look after you and raise raise you as a child. All of these things impact your emotions and your cognitions. And then on top of that, there's all the things that you do in your life. If you, from reading self-help books to what they teach you at school, I 100% agree with you. We need to start teaching school kids these skills. And the good news is that in some schools it is happening, acceptance and commitment therapy. Not so much in Australia, but in the UK and in some parts of the USA, you know, primary school kids are starting to learn these things. I hope it kind of gets disseminates much faster and much wider. But yes, multiple factors. You know, if you're in a war zone, it's absolutely ridiculous advice to say, well, don't worry. You know, I mean, how can you not? The cool thing, what I can tell you is that I wrote a protocol based on acceptance and commitment therapy for the World Health Organization. And they've been rolling this out in refugee camps all around the world for over a decade now. And what they found is a 10-hour program where people learn the skills that we've been talking about, dropping anchor and unhooking from thoughts and living their values within the refugee camp. And that protocol has shown that from 10 hours of that, people get significant reductions in PTSD and depression. So people can learn these skills and in a relatively short space of time, you know, so there is hope.
That is really significant, Russ. Thank you for sharing that. I suppose in the last 30 seconds we have, any final thoughts for the warriors out there?
Well, as I said to you at the start of the, before we came on, you know, I love the Bobby Farin song, you know, Don't Worry, Be Happy, but it's completely unrealistic. The lyrics are something about, you know, with the landlord saying you can't pay the bills and they're going to litigate, don't worry, be happy. That's just rubbish, you know. But what we can do is kind of have a look at our worries. Is it pointing to something important that requires action? And if our worries are having a huge impact on our health and well-being, we can learn these skills relatively quickly to get much better at dealing with them.
Dr. Russ Harris, really appreciate your time and spending time with me today. I hope that you feel a little less anxious now that we've done it once together.
Thank you. As you made it a very safe place.
That's really lovely to hear. Dr. Russ Harris is a physician, psychotherapist, and author. He is an internationally renowned expert on ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. And his book is called The Happiness Trap, Stop Struggling, Start Living. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.